Welcome to the Nordic Model Now podcast, providing critical narratives on the global sex trade.
Good evening, everyone.
Hi.
Welcome to this Nordic Model Now event, Prostitution and the Trade Union Movement. Tonight, we are here to talk about prostitution and the trade union movement. And the topic under discussion is, which is the best fit, the Nordic model or completely criminalisation? So obviously the trade union movement has been responsible for some of the greatest social justice breakthroughs in society. Trade unionists have fought tenaciously over centuries against excessive hours of work and dangerous working conditions, and fought for decent pay and holiday pay and sick pay, and for workers to be treated with dignity as well as safely. Unions exist to advocate for workers' rights, but many of the rights that we will think of as intrinsic in the UK are incompatible with prostitution. Considering prostitution through the lens of employment law shows how different prostitution is from all other jobs. Workers in the UK are protected by health and safety legislation, for example. They're protected from carrying out dangerous activities which could harm their health. And those laws include prohibitions on not being required by your employer to regularly come into contact with other people's bodily fluids, for example. Even if you work in the medical profession, much less in the service industry. There's no service industry job in which a worker is expected to touch or ingest semen or saliva from customers, much less blood, urine, or feces. The risk of contracting sexually transmitted diseases or suffering injuries, including gynecological injuries, such as inflammation, infection, prolapse, are also not risks that any other worker in any other service industry can be asked to undertake. Employment law also protects pregnant workers, protects them from the kind of activities that are just part and parcel of prostitution. A pregnant woman is entitled to a risk assessment by her employer to determine if the activities she's carrying out at work are dangerous or arduous, like carrying heavy loads, holding the same position for a long period of time, not having breaks, or exposure to dangerous substances. Having sex with multiple men in one day entails those risks. And all of this would be completely unacceptable in any other service industry job, but it is the nature of the job in prostitution. Trying to apply sexual harassment law to prostitution also shows us how impossible it is for prostitution to be treated as a normal job. If I work in a pub, for example, my employer has a duty to protect me from unwanted behaviour of a sexual nature, from my colleagues as well as from clients, customers. This behaviour can include things like making sexual remarks about my body, clothing, my sex life, my appearance, telling sexually offensive jokes, or showing pornographic or sexual content at work. But those prescribed activities I have just listed would be part of prostitution. An employer or a punter is definitely going to make sexual remarks about a person's body. So how could employment law protect me in the same way as it would if I had another service industry job? No one argues that we should suspend the application of sexual harassment law in prostitution, because that would mean a woman in prostitution cannot be sexually harassed. And quite rightly, no one argues either that employment laws shouldn't apply to prostitution. In fact, one of the arguments for full decriminalisation is that it will mean that everybody is protected by employment laws. But just the two examples I've given, health and safety and sexual harassment, show how regular employment law just can't apply to prostitution. There are many more ways in which prostitution can't be compliant with employment law or human rights law, for example, Sex Discrimination and the Equality Act. And it's either a job like any other, or it's anomalous, and it's something that can't fall within the remit of employment law. Our view in Nordic Model Now is that prostitution can never be a normal job, and that normalising it through bringing it into the union movement and classifying people in prostitution as workers is not the right way to tackle the harms. Survivors and those exploited in prostitution tell us that the experience wreaks havoc on the individual emotionally, psychologically, and physically. The existence of prostitution in our society also causes wider damage that entrenches inequality between men and women in particular, and it sanctions sexual violence on an enormous scale. The fact is that prostitution is mostly done by women, and most of the punters are men. And living in a world where girls leaving school could be offered jobs in prostitution in the same way as they're offered jobs at Pizza Express or any other service industry job only entrenches misogynist ideas about the roles of men and women in our society. Our speakers tonight are going to explain exactly what the Nordic model is and what it offers, how it compares with full decriminalisation, and explain why full decriminalisation isn't the answer. So I would now like to invite our first speaker, Helen, to speak to you.
Hi, my name's Helen. I'm here from Nordic Model now. Before I begin, I just want to say that at the end of this, I will give you, there'll be a link that will come up where you can find the references for all the studies and data that I mention while I'm speaking. Prostitution is a personal and important issue for me for two main reasons. Number one, I grew up in the shadow of the what I call sexploitation industry. I was indoctrinated into thinking that the sexual objectification, humiliation and oppression of women is normal. That the female function is to be of service, use and, wherever possible, a pleasure to and for men. It took me decades to realise that my beliefs were the core of my, our, female oppression. Secondly, I live in the Netherlands, where prostitution is legal. I am appalled by the casual acceptance of the notion that some women choose to be fodder for men and that non-prostituted women have a right to the amorphous safety provided by the fact that some women are being prostituted. To understand an appropriate solution to a problem, we first need to have a realistic understanding of what that problem actually is. So what is prostitution really? Many people assume that it is consensual sex that involves a negotiation about what will happen. That two parties, the woman and the punter, are equally placed in this negotiation. I'm going to draw on the words of prostitution survivors to show that this isn't true. First, Emily. She got into financial difficulties when she was at university and swallowed the promoted notion that sex work is a real job with good money, a no-brainer for cash-strapped students like herself. She started in prostitution. This is what she says. I was sold a complete lie. It's not easy money. To the buyer, you are nothing more than an object for consumption, not an actual human being with emotions. You're expected to just put up with whatever they want to do and say to you. The exchange of money makes them feel entitled to treat you however they like, with no regard for your feelings or consent. Esther echoes this. The punter is king. It's a total myth that you can negotiate with them as an equal when you're in a private space operating in a competitive market and under the threat of bad online reviews, reprisals from the brothel manager, and or violence from your pimp. It's nothing like the type of exchange you'd have with a sexual partner outside of the sex trade. So I always think about health and safety notices that you would see at work. This slide shows what one might look like for prostitution. Some of the risks: infections, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, herpes, hepatitis, HIV and more, unwanted pregnancy, injuries, including tears, abrasions, fissures and fistulas to the vagina, anus and rectum, damage to internal, abdominal and pelvic organs caused by prolonged and heavy pounding, and injuries elsewhere caused by punter violence, brain injury, including through strangulation and other acts of physical violence. Mental health impacts, high levels of PTSD and other mental disorders correlating to the high levels of violence. Condoms can't give protection from these hazards. And anyway, many men refuse to wear them or stealth them off. In any job, other job that carried such risks, workers would be required to wear full protective clothing. But that's impossible in prostitution. Why do we expect women to be exposed to such risks and no other worker would tolerate, especially when its only purpose is to feed men's entitlement and egos? If it's not possible to make work safe, industries are closed down, like the as asbestos industry was. We believe that prostitution can never be made safe, and we therefore call for the Nordic model, which aims to reduce the size of the industry and the numbers of people involved. Before we move on to an explanation of the Nordic model, I want to take a moment to look at what buying sex does to men. And when I say buying sex, let's be clear, he's not paying for mutual sex between two consenting adults who fancy each other. He pays because she wouldn't have sex with him otherwise, and he doesn't want to have to think about her feelings and needs. It's a one-sided sexual activity in which he has control. He pays to be the king of the situation. So what does that do to a person? It increases his sense of entitlement and reduces his empathy, particularly for women. It makes him feel that one-sided sex is normal and that it's his right to be in control and have his own way. These are exactly the attitudes that researchers found to underline most male violence against women and girls. Multiple studies show that men who pay for sex are significantly more likely than other men to rape and engage in all forms of violence against women. One US study found that punters were nearly 8 times more likely to rape than other men. This means that the more prostitution that's in place, the more male violence against women and girls you're likely to find in the general community. So prostitution is not a private matter. It impacts the entire community. Okay, so what is the Nordic model exactly? It's the only approach to prostitution policy and legislation that recognises prostitution as a part of the structural oppression of women. It is both a cause and a consequence of the persistent inequality between the sexes. The Nordic model was introduced in Sweden in 1999 after extensive research revealed A, the extent of women's suffering in prostitution, and B, sex buyers' ignorance, ignorance, and lack of care of the consequences of their actions. The researchers developed the idea of one-sided criminalization, where buyers, rather than those selling sex, would be held accountable. In brief, one, the Nordic model decriminalizes selling sex because no one should be criminalized for enduring exploitation and abuse. Two, it invests in services that provide support and genuine roots out of the industry. Most research shows that around 90% of those involved at any given time want to get out but can't see how to. The services need to include access to housing, training, childcare, legal and financial assistance, psychosocial support, and drug rehabilitation. Three, the Nordic model makes buying sex a criminal offence. The key aim is to change attitudes and men's behaviour, to create a society where no one could even imagine that anyone has the right to pay to sexually use and or abuse another human being. Four, the Nordic model strengthens laws against trafficking, pimping and brothel keeping. Five, there also needs to be a plethora of holistic measures, including training for the police, public information campaigns, education in schools, and concrete measures to address poverty and inequality. Where the Nordic model is implemented well, it has been shown to reduce the size of the industry and to create a hostile destination for international sex buyers and traffickers. In Sweden, it has brought about a change in the culture and men's behaviour. It has widespread public support, particularly among women and young people. Prostitution hasn't been eliminated, but surveys indicate that the number of Swedish men buying sex dropped by 50% in the first 15 years of its operation. It's not surprising, therefore, that pimps and lobbyists for the exploitation, for the expansion of the industry, hate the Nordic model. They insist it's more dangerous for women involved, which is simply not true. Let's have a look. What the pimps and lobbyists want is full decriminalisation, which makes all aspects of the sex trade legal. Pimps, brothel keepers are transformed into respectable business people, and buying sex is like going down to the pub or having a haircut. Under full decriminalisation, prostitution is regarded as a standard business, so there's no public funding for services to help women exit. Laws against trafficking are retained, but in practice they are rarely and difficult to enforce. New Zealand pioneered full decriminalisation in 2003. It is claimed by lobbyists and even the New Zealand government that there has been a decrease in the number of people involved, that it's safer for women, that women can refuse can refuse clients or particular services, that brothels have regular health inspections, and that condom use is compulsory. These are the claims. However, the data in the New Zealand government's own assessment does not support a single one of these claims. The data actually shows that after the law was passed, there was a rapid increase in the size of the industry. Violence and coercion remain rife. Women can seldom refuse clients or specific acts. Unprotected sex is common because men always or nearly always ask for it. And there were 11 brothel inspections in 12 years, even though more than 1,000 brothel licenses were granted during that time. This slide compares the two approaches. The left-hand column shows what full decriminalisation means. Selling sex, pimping, brothels and buying sex are illegal. And because it's considered a normal job, there's no public money invested to help women exit. The right-hand column shows the Nordic model. Selling sex is legal, but pimping, brothels and buying sex are illegal. And therefore, there is specific public funding for high-quality, holistic services to provide support and genuine roots out to all those who want it. Germany and Netherlands have legalised prostitution, which in theory is different from full decriminalisation. However, there are in fact many similarities. For example, in both Germany and New Zealand, there is a massive industry with huge numbers of people involved. Both have multi-storey brothels operating in plain sight. Pimps and brothel owners are considered respectable business people. In Germany, around 1 million men pay women for sex every single day. This chart uses publicly available data to show the percentage of the population involved in prostitution in six countries. Germany and the Netherlands with legalisation, New Zealand with decriminalisation, and Sweden, Norway and France with the Nordic model. This shows that a much smaller proportion of the population is involved in prostitution under the Nordic model. This would suggest that the Nordic model is effective in reducing the size of the industry, or at least in preventing its growth. Decriminalisation lobbyists say that the Nordic model is more dangerous for women involved. If this were true, we would expect to see higher rates of homicide of women involved in prostitution in countries that have implemented the Nordic model, and lower rates in countries that have legalisation or decriminalisation. This chart shows the number of prostituted women murdered by pimps or punters expressed as an average annual rate per 100,000 female citizens during the years the legislative framework was in place. As you can clearly see, the homicide of women involved in prostitution is significantly higher in New Zealand, Germany and the Netherlands than it is in Sweden, Norway or France. This suggests that the claim that the Nordic model is more dangerous for the women involved is false. However, we need to be clear. We are not claiming that the Nordic model is safer for women, because we don't believe that anything can make prostitution safe. Instead, the Nordic model aims to reduce the amount of prostitution that takes place and the number involved. The data suggests that when implemented well, the Nordic model is successful in this. The fact is, prostitution is a very dangerous occupation. Far more dangerous than being a firefighter, taxi driver, or police officer. I will end with a quote from an article by Valerie Hudson, an American academic. The homicide rate for prostitutes is 229 per 100,000, which is higher than the highest workplace homicide rate of any other occupation. E.g., taxi drivers, 27 in 100,000. And US soldiers, including combat-related deaths, 27 in 100,000 between 1980 and 2010. Yeah, prostituted women, excuse me, are almost 10 times more likely to be killed at their work than soldiers in combat. There is literally no category of work with a homicide rate as high as prostitution. This should tip us off to the fact that it is not work, but in fact, a form of socially sanctioned violence. As promised, here's a QR code and a link to a version of this talk that provides references for all the claims and data that I've mentioned. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Esther. I'm the policy advisor at Nordic Model Now and a survivor of pornography and prostitution. Brighton is where I first became involved in the sex industry. So, when employers recruit new staff, it's standard practice to create a job description and often a person specification explaining what the role involves and the type of person they're looking to recruit. Here's what an accurate job description and person specification for prostitution would have to include. General tasks: sexual activity with multiple male strangers, regardless of their age, appearance, attitude, health, and hygiene. Every orifice must be available. Reenact degrading scenes from porn. Responsibilities: do whatever the buyer wants, even if it hurts or disgusts you. Never complain. Simulate pleasure. Be convincing. Buyer is always right. Abandon personal boundaries and health and safety standards to stay competitive. Desirable qualifications. As young or with as little previous experience in the sex trade as possible. Ability to dissociate. Preferably poor and vulnerable with a lack of social support. A history of sexual abuse, exploitation, self-harm, homelessness, or a childhood spent in care. Career development pathway. Downwards, the longer you spend in the role. Lengthy experience makes you less desirable. Potential negative impact on future career, health and well-being, and ability to work. Social isolation. Substance abuse. As Helly mentioned, employers must post health and safety notices in workplaces advising employees of health and safety risks. And this is a shortened version of the health and safety notice for prostitution and what it would look like. Henny also mentioned the homicide rate for women involved in prostitution. The incidence of PTSD is also double the rate and more complex than that found in combat veterans. Traumatic brain damage at rates comparable to victims of torture. Rates of brain injury like or greater than those found in professional boxers. Exposure to risk, higher risk, is not a consequence of the introduction of the Nordic model. In July 2024, the European Court of Human Rights unanimously held that France had not violated Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, that's the right to private and family life, by introducing the Nordic model in 2016. The court said that the negative effects about the dangers and harms which the applicants described and had attributed to the introduction of the Nordic model had already existed and been observed in France before the non-ruling model was introduced there. The court also noted that you could reasonably infer from this that prostitution is inherently violent. It is, because it's a form of violence against women and girls, not work. What would the implications be for workplace health and safety practices, which are costly for employers to implement and maintain, particularly in the health and social care sectors, if these were considered acceptable workplace risks? So, retailers can legally price commodities differently based on their origin, age, etc. Our consumer protection laws let you choose to buy or sell commodities of this description, such as the cheeses on this slide, which are all from different countries and priced differently per 100 grams. You agree a price based on this description. But employers cannot legally pay people differently based on their age, sex, race, and other protective characteristics. In the sex trade, however, it is standard to charge different rates for women based on their age and ethnicity in particular. This would be unlawful discrimination under the Equality Act 2010 if prostitution was fully decriminalised and considered a form of work. Notice that the brothel charges twice as much for white Russian women than for Asian women. This doesn't just happen in other countries. On UK punter forums, sex buyers review women they've paid for sex acts and tell other buyers how much they paid. They pay almost twice as much for white women who speak English fluently, particularly if they appear educated. These payment practices are standard because the sex buyer is king, and particularly fetishizes ethnicity and social class. Some characteristics buyers use to determine how much they're willing to pay, such as ethnicity, are also hate crime characteristics in the UK. The price differences reflect notions of subjugation and conquest and myths about female sexuality. They wouldn't be accepted or defended as the exercise of autonomy or choice in any other service industry, because they are incompatible with equality legislation and human dignity. The legalised sex industry in Germany likes to market itself as a form of healthcare. Some mega brothels in Germany segregate prostituted women by ethnicity and other characteristics, including gender identity, on different floors of the building. Would you expect to be able to choose which floor of a healthcare facility you went to based on the protected characteristics of the staff assigned to provide services there? If prostitution were fully decriminalised or legalised in the UK, other industries would inevitably ask why they must cover the financial and regulatory costs of complying with equality legislation while prostitution does not. It's highly likely that equivalent demands would be made by users of other services, particularly health and social care. How would you prevent them? How could a union which supported these practices in one industry deny the entitlement in another? All of this would seriously affect the operation of the Equality Act 2010 itself. Agreements involving paying for sexual acts are regarded as contracts for an immoral purpose in England and Wales, and they're generally unenforceable on the grounds of illegality. This would have to change for prostitution contracts to be enforceable if full decriminalisation were introduced. But doing so could have wider implications. What courts call a consistent course of previous dealing between parties to a contract, or the custom of the relevant trade, can result in terms becoming incorporated into contracts over time without being written down. Could that include providing sexual services for benefit outside the sex industry? Courts can refuse to enforce what they consider onerous or unusual contract terms. Well, these onerous terms include expectations that staff provide sexual services to employers or managers in return for career advancement, if courts would enforce providing payment for the same services in prostitution. When would sex at work not be work? What would be an onerous or unusual contract term in prostitution itself? Some services buyers demand, because they've been normalised in online porn, have been recognised as torture by global human rights organisations when committed by state agents or permitted to happen by states within that state's territory. Prices buyers pay for these services have come down in recent years because of competition due to increasing numbers of women being drawn into prostitution by their very precarious circumstances. You cannot consent to torture. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Jenna, and I'm going to be speaking on my perseverance of prostitution. I've worked in various settings in the sex industry, but left it for good several years ago. That's obviously a brief introduction to who I am and why I'm here. But of course, that's not all I am. I'm not just an ex-prostitute. I'm also a mother, a partner. I have a job that I'm qualified to do. And I'm also not really Jenna. That's just the name I use when I'm talking about my experiences. I do that because it's part of my life that I don't always want to remember or to be associated with. When women leave the sex industry, sometimes it's really hard not to go back. Decriminalising all aspects of the industry, including the pimps and the buyers, would just be yet another callback. Another reason you could find yourself back where you don't want to be. It's really easy to buy sex. It's as easy as ordering a takeaway. And sometimes not much more money. And I don't agree that it should be that way. We're humans. We're not products to be consumed and then rated out of 10. These men that buy sex, they are in your lives. They're hospital workers, shop assistants. They're men in your office. They are not a different class of men. And the women who sell sex are not a different class of women. We feel things the same way you do. When I said stop, you're hurting me, repeatedly. I was just a sex worker being difficult. When a woman says that outside of that setting, it's rape. Well, for me, it felt the same. It felt like rape, because that's what it was. When men secretly remove condoms, that's rape too. The problem with a society that turns a blind eye to the oppression of women and says that sex work is work is that we have no idea who we can trust. Getting into prostitution can feel like a life sentence, even after you leave. The nightmares, the reminders, the feelings that pop up when you're just trying to be happy. The buyers don't have that. They are all allowed anonymity. They don't see the consequences for the damage that's caused. So what if we make it all legitimate? Try and give it a sense of respectability by decriminalising the industry. Will things change for the women? Will the men no longer show up dirty and showered? Will the ones that cause pain now change their minds about it? Will they no longer show up with dirt under their fingernails? I have my doubts, but it will certainly make life easier for these men and for the people who profit from the women they're using. There is life after prostitution, there is hope, but we need to be able to call it out for what it is, and that's abuse. I consider myself lucky, because when I wanted to leave, it was at a time when I could. And even though it's been hard and I still have wobbles, even now, today, I would never go back. 4D crim to me means fair game. It's saying that this industry, this secret backstreet world of men using women in some of the most extreme ways imaginable, is okay. It's not our job to titillate men and make sure their fantasies are fulfilled. That's not our job or our responsibility as women. Although you can see why younger or more vulnerable women and girls might think otherwise. If the first time you're seeing sex is on a screen that is showing men violating and hurting women, then you can see where the confusion comes from. If the first time you've been touched is as a child by an adult you should have been able to trust, then you can see where the confusion lies. This is the reality for so many of us who have ended up in the industry. You cannot look me in the eye and tell me sex work is empowering. Holding men to account, showing women that justice can be done, freeing women to be their own people and achieve on their own terms, that's empowerment. It's the Nordic model that can reach for this, not 4D crim. Extreme sexual practices and so-called sex work has become normalised, and the extreme nature of it has become so distorted that it can be barely recognised as sex anymore. We can't keep going like this. We're already seeing the effects on OnlyFans creators, the women who attend parties, as well as women who work in places like parlours. We've reached a point where we can see the damage caused. Do we really want more women working in the industry? Because like I said, they are just normal women. They don't have superpowers not to feel. And the men are just normal men. People always realise the damage being done. In the years since I left, I've had some amazing support that has changed my life. I've had that breathing space to be able to reflect and to really acknowledge what I went through. Women who leave need that. I've had people close to me say, some women love it. And I wouldn't have said that to you, I would. Now it would be my worst nightmare. Amazingly, people make the same statements about men hurting women. If a man enjoys choking a woman or using a whip, it's consensual. Don't kink shame. We hurt each other and we get used to being hurt. That's not enlightened. Sometimes I get really sad about how accepted this all is. I truly dread to think how many more women would be harmed, how many more men would become regular buyers if 4D crim was brought in. What we have isn't working. More people involved is not going to solve the problems. What we need is an approach that actually recognises the harm, that doesn't minimise it or waters it down. As we've said today, the Nordic model won't stop every single woman being hurt, but we need a starting point. We have to jump off this train that is headed for complete devastation. I myself have attempted suicide many times over the years. I wish I could just forget all the things that happened. But I can't forget, I can just inform. I can try to stop other women from being harmed. And you can too. We can't be squeamish when it comes to making important changes. We have to face up to what we're up against and be honest about it. The young people in our lives need us to protect them and to help them feel safe, boys and girls. So please advocate for young people and say no to decriminalisation and prostitution.
Hi, I'm Sarah Green. I'm the chief executive of a small charity in King's Cross in very central London. Some of you will already know King's Cross is, or used to be, synonymous with prostitution. The term itself kind of had that ring about it, and going to King's Cross was associated with, I'm going to go and buy a woman who's in prostitution. I am here to tell you a little bit about the organisation, Women at the Well, and the work that we do. And then, in particular, this interesting question of what actually happens to women, like to women who may be around prostitution and other sexually exploitative practices right now, What happens to them if and when they're trying to seek support? For example, when the ideology around and the ideas around sex work have captured some of our services and some of the mainstream and parts of our culture, because it's got real consequences and real implications now. It's not just ideas, which is the way it's treated by some of those who play with it as being about ideology and ideas. So I'll give you a little background on our organisation so you get the context I'm coming from, but then I'll talk about the women we're working with and what that framing is already doing in women's lives. So we're about, our organisation is about 20 years old. We run three kind of integrated services, a drop-in centre, strictly in a strictly women-only building, where women can come for food, for showers, for laundry, some basic need stuff, some company. We've got activities on every day. It's kind of quite a nice place to be. Very, very rare women-only daytime provision in central London. Quite a lot of women walk quite a long way to come and be with us some days of the week, and valued and important. And the idea of having drop-in, so something with no appointment, where there won't be any pressure on you, where there won't be somebody immediately problematising you or who's obliged to help you in a statutory service type setting, is really, really important. So women all over the world, over decades, have developed a good method for what works around prostitution, for supporting women to get out when they're ready to. And one of the answers is drop-in work like this, like just being open door and being ready, obviously being non-judgmental, and then being able to go at women's pace. So not rushing women or saying, right, let's kind of hammer down your problems into categories and you know, be bossy about sorting things out. We need to be organised in this way, which is open door and we're going at your pace and we have absolutely zero judgment of you. After our drop-in service, we've got then wraparound advocacy. So there are workers there who are ready to do some accompaniment type work with women often, so tackling things like housing problems. All of the women who come to us have got insecure housing problems, London, but that will be the case in lots of parts of the country. We work with a lot of women who've got different problems with their health, physical health as much as mental health, and chronic physical health problems are a real barrier to both keeping you in poverty but also to making changes in your life. And then lots of other issues around destitution and poverty and so on. So our advocacy workers are there to help try and work that out and go at women's pace. They are. They also work alongside outreach workers. So we have a mini team of three women who can go out to the different parts of London where we know or where we hear there's still some street prostitution, often involving extremely vulnerable women and a lot of risk. And also to other parts of London where there are where women are in women-only spaces, like a couple of the women-only hostels and other places like that. Now, I've taken some time to explain what we've got as a very small charity. Before I tell you that we're not commissioned, which means that neither the local council nor London Mayor, for example, nor any part of national government is paying for the work that we do, because there is barely any commissioning of this kind of support. And when we talk about what as a society we want for women and what is women's equality, and when we talk about what should the legal model be around the ability to exit, we've got to be serious about the fact that already, right now, we don't do anything to enable women to exit, even those who are able to articulate and say they want to exit. There isn't commissioning of this kind of work. And we're doing it off the back of trusts and foundations, kind of old-fashioned, shake a tin sometimes, charity fundraising. And really, in the future, we need to envision something quite different. The right to have support to get out of sexually exploitative and abusive situations is clearly a right. It shouldn't be done on the basis that we're doing it. So kind of a big issue for us. I've described a little bit what is going on in the lives of the women we work with. So many of the women we saw, I should give you a couple of numbers, so quite a small charity, we employ 12 people, we have 20 volunteers and our turnover is about £700,000, so that's the, you know, as an entity, that's what we are. Last year we reached more than 1,000 women, which is, on if you like to evaluate charities, that's good reach. That's in terms of women who came to our drop-in centre, women we've met on the streets, and then about 200 women who at any one time are engaged in long-term work with us to try and sort out some issues in their lives. So really good reach and good value, again, social value, if you measure charity work that way. Those women that we're working with are involved sometimes, so in what people usually understand by prostitution, so the exchange of sex acts for cash, either in their history or at the moment. Many are involved in what some people call survival sex or exchange. So that's where there isn't cash, but where they might be exchanging for to feed an addiction or for basic life needs, somewhere to stay, for safety, because they're safer with the person they're with than elsewhere. We are working with women whose properties have been cuckooed, like a huge problem in London but around the country. But cuckooing, which is extremely vicious and which the law is still not settled on, commonly involves sexual coercion when it's vulnerable and in single women's flats have been taken over. Very vicious people who organise that, often related to the drugs trade. We work with migrant women who've been trafficked for sexual exploitation, and you know, despite some of the claims that we hear about having good law and practice and anti-slavery stances around this, actually those women get lost and they can be very unsure of their status and what will happen if they are known to the authorities. They can also be being threatened and will have been told often by traffickers that if you make yourselves known, you're going to be principally an immigration offender, so don't try to seek any kind of support. We're also, among the women we're working with, we will get now, in our current kind of cultural context, women who are vulnerable in many ways, and I know this, you know, language is so difficult in this area, isn't it? A lot of people don't like that term, but I can't find another good term for some of the women we work with. Those women will, for example, now come across OnlyFans as an option and might ask some of our workers, you know, do you think this is better, or do you think this is safe, or can I do this, or can you help me with it? So there's a, even when you've got somebody who is has already faced a lot of risk, who's already sought some kind of company and support, there's this kind of intervention now of something that's presenting itself as simpler, easier, safer, and so on. And it's extremely worrying because of what is known already about OnlyFans and the way that women are groomed into what initially seems to be quite simple activity and are then approached by those who market their pages and content and will soon encourage them into something that they've not understood it was ever going to be that way. So really the intrusion of that kind of invitation now, because of how fluid both real life and contact prostitution and sexual exploitation are with everything that's available digitally, is quite something. It's quite something when in terms of law and policy, what we've got is indifference, I would say, to prostitution. What the context that we're working in, so I was going to describe what our charity's kind of big challenge at the moment, beyond trying to stay open and to fund it well, is really trying to work out what is the most effective outreach we can do for women where the prostitution is brokered entirely online through the websites that we've talked about a bit, and then which also takes place in flats, parlours and other private places. So this is something that models around reaching women on the streets are not quite suitable for, but women's groups are trying to organise and work out how do we reach these women. But we're doing this in a context where, again, in the same way that exiting services are not commissioned generally and are not supported to be able to help women to exit, we've also got indifference in terms of how much of this is happening, where is it happening, what's its nature, who's it happening to, and what even is its scale in a city like London. So I think it's important to understand with when we talk about the law and policy and where we want it to be, in terms of government, we don't even have a good answer to the question at the moment, how much prostitution is there in England and Wales? What is its nature and how does it happen? What's it connected to in the economy and crime and whatever else? Because the government's not trying to understand that. The last study that had a chance of assessing it was done in 2019 and couldn't conclude. And since then, despite all of our awareness really of this incredible digital transformation of the so-called industry, we no longer even know enough about it in terms of what's happening, who's it happening to. So we've got then a policing context and a social context, say for a charity like ours, where there's not good comprehension of what's happening in our neighbourhoods. So who does it involve? What kind of support might they need? And that's a really, really difficult context to operate in. I think personally, I think it suits both commissioners at local level through to national politicians for it to be quite out of sight and out of mind, because it is a bit more out of sight than when there was more prostitution on the street, in usually on particular roads and towns, particular roads and streets in all of our towns. So something important about that, I think, in terms of why it's not coming onto the policy landscape the way we need it to, a certain amount of indifference. The question then that I wanted to try and get to is, what is the living consequence of the kind of creep of the sex work framing for women who are at risk of or in prostitution now? I would recognise that for many workers, in particular in public sector settings, the creep and tendency to start using the term sex work, I appreciate that it often comes from a good place. Sex work as a term has been presented as something that's somehow neutral or polite or respectful, and in particular sexually non-judgmental, now that we're kind of decades on with so-called sexual revolutions and so on. So I do understand why individual workers might catch the language and might believe that they're being somehow polite or helpful in using it. But the reality of what is adopted when sex work is taken on as a term, say by people working in health or people working in addictions, people working in housing and so on, is that you've got your signalling that you do find the activity morally neutral and not that meaningful, and you're also closing down a woman's opportunity to talk about it if she wants to talk about it, and if in fact she needs to disclose that what is happening to her now or in the past is harmful and it's got roots and it's got reasons why she got there. So in minimising and kind of neutralising it, we're cutting off the opportunities and actually the rights that women should have to be able to be explicit and clear about the nature of it and what's happening to them and how they got there and the real kind of conversations they need to have and the help that they need to get. So we work with women all the time, this is kind of the empirical part, where they are also encountering lots of other services, and where health workers, for example sexual health workers or those who are around reproductive rights, also workers from GPs, primary care, through to hospitals, if the fact of prostitution comes up, we'll use the neutralising terms and are, in effect, sometimes closing down the opportunity for a different conversation about what's going on in women's lives. Those who are working in addictions, who might understand that a woman is involved in prostitution, will similarly, when using these terms, approach then the prostitution as something that's really just about harm reduction and a bit of safety as much as anything else. And that's also a missed opportunity for somebody who might really need to talk. In other services, there's a bit of a contrast, which I think is interesting, and I think which helps to kind of give the lie to some of what's going on. In housing, it's probably better if your involvement in prostitution is not known, because it's not going to particularly help your chances and your points for where you are in the system, or for landlords or other kind of trusting you as a reliable tenant. In terms of other charities who are doing a lot of commissioned work, so you know, state-funded work with women, they might be running hostels or advice services, refuges even, or mental health services. When they are captured by some of this language, they can also be signalling to women that the prostitution is not particularly a priority around what's going on with you, and this is also not a place where you might be able to make a disclosure and to seek some extra help. In social care, if your involvement in prostitution in your past or your present is known, that can very significantly count against you. Women will often know actually not to disclose at all, but if it did become known, for example, from a third party, it is going to affect a woman's the judgment on her about whether she's able to and should be able to look after her children, which is ironic when you think about that alongside the way domestic violence victims are also judged for their ability to care properly for their children and to be trusted to do so. So you've got a recognition of victimhood in one place and not in the other. In policing, from my working experience in London and from what I know of other organisations like ours in a couple of other parts of the country, our legal situation, our legal and political model means that actually we've got what is something very laissez-faire, kind of quite British, but an approach which is undecided about prostitution. So it means that different police forces are doing very different things, and actually quite unaccountable people at the top of those forces can make their own minds up about what the approach should be in a given area. So that's a bit of a reflection on how different workers doing their job, often with every good intention, can be closing down or affecting women's ability to seek support and sending a signal about what prostitution and the harms that are in different kinds of sexual exploitation really mean and the impact of that. And I think it's, I've jumbled it around a bit, but it's a really important thing for those, no doubt, who are in unions and in our public sector professions to really think about, to think about the implication of doing this, because I think it is the case that lots of us are being gaslit when we're encouraged to just accept the sex work terminology. Lots of women, I believe, have a strong sense that that doesn't actually feel quite right, but I'm not supposed to say that anymore because it's somehow impolite or something. For women who are actually in prostitution or who have been in their past, they are having language transmitted at them all the time, which is neutralising what's happened to them, and which is saying that it's not kind of morally a question, or that it's just to be regarded as any other work. And that, you know, for some women, that's actually quite insulting and quite problematic. In terms of where we go next, I think a part of this message today is about the questioning of this terminology and what it is already done, kind of culturally, politically, socially. Policy-wise, the government has this huge mission to halve violence against women and girls in a decade. There is a real question about whether prostitution is going to feature in that strategy. Now, if you look at the harms, if you look at rates, if you look at rates for domestic violence and sexual violence, which are kind of fairly well counted, those factors are always drivers in the lives of women who become involved in prostitution. You can't have a strategy that's about halving violence against women and girls in a decade and that sets out to do that in a purposeful way and then not include the set of women who are the most serially offended against and who are subject to the most harm, and as some of the other presentations have shown, actually the most risk. It also has the effect of having absolutely no curiosity about who the men are who are using those women, because, as we've also already said, it's not average or ordinary men who often do this. It's men who already have extremely misogynistic attitudes, and those men are part of the harm in the rest of the community. So it's foolish in the extreme, more than foolish, political, to think of leaving prostitution out of violence against women and girls strategies, but that's what we're facing, and it's really important that trade union activists and others and everybody around Labour lobbies hard for that not to, to happen. That's a lot of what I wanted to say.
You've been listening to the Nordic Model Now podcast. Nordic Model Now is a UK grassroots women's group campaigning for the abolition of prostitution and related practices such as lap dancing, pornography and surrogacy. Find us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Nordic Model Now, or visit our website at nordicmodelnow.org. Thank you.